Hello, podcast person, and you're a very special person if you're downloading this. Thanks for choosing this podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, host of The Takeaway, a program that's produced by WNYC and Public Radio International.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry today. Thank you so much for listening. We bring you closer to the negotiating tables this hour, a couple of different views of the faltering ceasefire in Ukraine and the hard negotiating work of German Chancellor Angela Merkel there. But we begin with another attack from the Islamic State. On Sunday, ISIS released yet another horrific execution video. This time, 21 Egyptian Christians were decapitated on what appeared to be the Libyan coast near the capital city of Tripoli. Last week, intelligence officials said that ISIS is expanding to militant groups in the Middle East and North Africa beyond Syria and Iraq. Several groups have publicly declared allegiance to ISIS, and now this video. It's the first time ISIS has released an official video showing these executions outside of Syria and Iraq.
Egypt reserves the right to respond at the proper time and in the appropriate style in retaliation for those inhuman criminal killers, and I have called for the National Defense Council to convene to follow up on the development of this issue.
That's Egypt's President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi speaking on state TV hours before launching some bombing raids in Libya, the Egyptian military launching airstrikes at training camps and arms depots there. But the new attacks mean that some of the fears of the countries fighting ISIS in Iraq and Syria may have been realized. That is that ISIS is expanding its reach and its message to other countries. Joining me now is Sarah Foyer, Sorif Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Studies. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
So the latest video showing these horrific murders that appear to take place in Libya, what does that mean for the message that ISIS is trying to send to the world?
Well, it's pretty stark, but it's important to remember that there were groups in Libya that had been proclaiming their allegiance to ISIS going back a few months now. And so there were growing voices expressing concern about the real possibility of ISIS spreading not only its message, but also its horrifying tactics.
So that would suggest that the perpetrators of this video may not be transplants from the war in Iraq, but Libyan Islamists who are operating under the ISIS brand, if you will. Is that a distinction without a difference? Does it matter?
I'm not really sure it matters ultimately. I mean, there were reports over the last few months of fighters traveling from Syria to Libya, which signaled to some analysts a growing communication and coordination between the two. But ultimately, I'm not sure that it really makes a difference.
Al-Qaeda had a similar message for more than 10 years. There was a core Al-Qaeda group and then the possibility to franchise, if you will, that Islamist groups in countries around the world, from Afghanistan to Yemen, Somalia, Sudan, and Libya, had the opportunity to operate under the Al-Qaeda brand. Is this functionally different with ISIS? Does it change our calculus at all if another militant, horrific Islamic group is doing much the same thing, operating in one place and selling a franchise elsewhere?
I think it's a little bit soon to tell whether this franchising actually represents a new model to be distinguished from what Al-Qaeda has been doing. But it's important to remember also that some of this may also reflect internal rivalries, even among the more radical Islamist groups there. So there are some reports that there has been fighting between groups that would have been more likely to associate with Al-Qaeda and those arguing for an affiliation now with ISIS. So it's just dizzying.
Sarah Foyer, one of the debates that's going on here in the United States, of course, is over an authorization for military force in a war against Islamic State. One of the key parts of that debate is whether or not any geographic limitations should be placed on the authorization, whether the president should be authorized just to fight them in Iraq and possibly Syria or anywhere that ISIS may rear its head. And this latest action seems to speak directly to that.
Right. Well, up to now, when it has come to Libya, at least, the United States has with its European partners, been issuing statements mostly just of support for the UN special, or rather the UN support mission in Libya. This is the UN-backed negotiating process. And as recently as earlier this month, the United States and its European allies issued a statement to the effect that there was no military solution to the what has effectively become the civil war in Libya. However, to the extent that Libya now becomes an outpost for ISIL or ISIS or whatever we're calling it today, then the fact that the Obama administration has sent this request for a new authorization for the use of military force to go after not only ISIL in Iraq and Syria, but also associated persons or groups. And as you, I think, rightly noted, there is no geographic limitation there. That suggests that a place like Libya could ultimately become the target of U.S. military action.
There have been other reports of ISIS officials arrested as far away as Afghanistan, which suggests that if the president has the green light to go after Islamic State anywhere in the world, it could be a brand new wider war.
Well, I think that's why you're seeing debate in the U.S. context and why Congress is going to be discussing this.
Sarah Foyer, SORA Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Thank you.
Thank you.
We move on to Copenhagen now, also on edge after a terror attack that left two dead and mirrored the Charlie Hebdo attacks in Paris just a few weeks ago. The attack in Copenhagen happened at a cafe where a seminar on art, blasphemy, and freedom of expression was being held. Lars Vilks is a well-known Swedish artist and featured speaker at the event, and he was thought to be the target. In 2007, Vilks drew a cartoon depicting the Prophet Muhammad as a dog, and that earned him a spot along with Stéphane Chabannier, the murdered editor of Charlie Hebdo, on Al-Qaeda's death list. Filmmaker Finn Norgaard was killed at the cafe, and a second man, Dan Uzan, a member of Denmark's Jewish community, was shot and killed outside a synagogue late Saturday night. Nearly half a dozen police officers were also injured in the incidents. Lars Eriksen is a journalist based in Copenhagen. He's been following the story for The Guardian, and he joins me now. Lars, welcome.
Hello, that's hot.
Well, Lars, Copenhagen is certainly a city not accustomed to this type of violence. Two shootings, as we described, and then the killing of the gunman. What is the mood now in the city?
It's kind of hard to describe. It's that kind of strange mix of, you know, sadness, defiance, confusion, anger, and grief. I mean, I think sort of the consensus here today is that Denmark is not quite the same country after what has happened this week. And I've been out today nearby the synagogue where the second shooting took place, and you have people sort of going about their everyday business. I saw some students milling out of the university who were talking about the latest assignments, and but then you also have this sea of flowers in front of the synagogue, and there is kind of a somber mood, but also definitely a sense of, you know, life goes on here.
Is there any type of recrimination, anger against the government? This type of attack, of course, happened just a month or two ago in Paris. This is similar in so many ways. Are people in Copenhagen upset at all that it came to their city?
I think the political debate will intensify during the course of the next couple of days. I think yesterday was very much a day of reflection, just getting to grips with news. I think there's a sort of a understanding between, you know, the political parties that, you know, there's a bit of a buffer before some of the bigger questions are being debated. But this is also, you know, we are potentially a few months away from election here, so this will obviously play pretty big. Some people have been out talking about maybe a need to reassess the sort of means available for the security and intelligence service here. There were obviously, you know, a slightly beefed up security, especially for the event at the cafe in light of what happened in Paris. But I think that will be one of the main questions, if there's a way of sort of reassessing how the security situation is here.
In terms of security at both the synagogue and the cafe, it should be pointed out, as tragic as those situations were, it seems as though the intended targets in both cases were not harmed. And that's something to remember.
Yes, I think with the cartoonist, the Swedish cartoonist Lars Vilks, he's under pretty much round the clock protection from the Swedish security police. There were Copenhagen policemen at that event as well, and also outside the synagogue. And I think one of the main things here is that people, in spite of this tragedy that has happened, thinking that this could have panned out a lot, lot worse if there hadn't been these security measures in place.
Lars Eriksen, you know, at the same time, Denmark is now confronting a lot of the same questions that France has been confronting, which is the suspect appears to have been a homegrown terrorist born in Denmark, raised there, lived in Danish culture, and then undertook this type of crime.
Yes, I think from off the bat, we kind of have probably to make clear that we don't really know the motive yet, even if police have said they would sort of work on the suspicion that he's potentially inspired by the Charlie Hebdo shootings or maybe some other kind of extremist group. It's all sort of being pieced together bit by bit at the moment by police and reporters here. Indications are that, yes, he's a 22-year-old Copenhagen born Dane who was known to police, had previous sentences, the last one for serious gun crime, and allegedly was only released from jail a few weeks ago. So he was known to authorities who had previously alerted him to the security services, but it's not yet known to what extent they were potentially monitoring him.
France has a long, long history with its Muslim population and its immigrant population, and a lot of that history has been contentious, especially recently. That's no secret, widely discussed after the Charlie Hebdo shootings in Paris. Does Denmark have a similar history? Does it have a similar number of immigrants, at least proportionally, in a similar kind of debate that France has?
The debate in Denmark it's intensified in recent years, but it's, if you compare it to something like Sweden, which has recently sort of seen the rise of quite anti-immigrant parties such as the Swedish Democrats, the Danish People's Party has been around for a long time and has been quite outspoken in the sort of in terms of their views. And I think what's been also intensifying here is the debate around around freedom of speech, especially in the light of the fact that before the Lars Vilks cartoon in 2007, there was the Muhammad cartoons published in the Danish newspaper Jyllandsposten in 2005, which is obviously coming up to the 10-year anniversary of that event later this year. And it's been a bit of a cloud hanging over Denmark in a way. It's a lot of people are saying now, well, it was not a question of if, it was a question of when something like this could happen in Denmark. But even saying that, I don't think that sort of even prepares people here for the kind of numbing sense of what a tragedy like this means for a small country when it happens.
No, and it seems with the 10-year anniversary of the original Muhammad cartoons in the Danish newspaper approaching, that security is bound to be ratcheted up even further. Lars Eriksen, contributor to The Guardian from Copenhagen. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Todd.
We take a moment now from the chaos and the fighting to stop and appreciate, if we can, the snow piling up in parts of the Northeast.
In a perfect world, it would start at 2 p.m. on Christmas Eve. On the radio, Peter and the Wolf. The snow would stop 24 hours later, about the time that crazy Uncle Harry walks through the door for his share of the holiday roast. Anything else? An abomination.
That's Peter Kadzis, senior editor at WGBHnews.org, sharing his 50 words on snow for us. And you can join in on our poetry program. Share your 50 words on snow at 8778MyTake or on Facebook at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
Most of us have met a Jehovah's Witness on our doorstep at one time or another. More than 8 million witnesses practice this kind of door-to-door ministry all around the world. Well, growing up in Fremont, California, Candace Conti was one of them.
As a kid, I just remember my whole opening spiel was, wouldn't you love to live in a beautiful place like this? There would be no sickness. There would be no death. Your loved ones that have passed away would be brought back to life.
But as Candace grew older, the church she loved so much became an ugly place because of one elder in particular. Now, a new investigation into the Jehovah's Witnesses has uncovered a widespread pattern of child sexual abuse and cover-up by church leaders. Trey Bundy, a reporter for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting, first started investigating this when a whistleblower sent him a package of policy memos from the Watchtower. That's the Witnesses' global headquarters in New York. All of the memos were clearly marked confidential.
The policy memos instruct the elders that they have to keep these matters confidential, that they're not to announce to the congregation when if they know of a child molester in their midst. They are not allowed to call police or any law enforcement until they've received direction from the watchtower.
That's a shocking part of your piece. These letters direct church officials throughout the country, don't call the cops, don't tell parents, don't tell anyone until we tell you what to do.
Correct. And they've been sending these memos for about 25 years. The most recent one was issued in November, and it was very clear. It said that elders should form internal judicial committees to deal with criminal matters involving Jehovah's Witnesses. And when they talk about criminal matters, they list a number of crimes, including murder, rape, and child abuse. So the idea is we're going to handle these matters internally. And it says in very specific language, strict confidentiality must be maintained in order to avoid unnecessary entanglements with secular authorities. In other words, we're keeping this quiet.
And as I understand it, there were several Bible passages included in these directives justifying the secrecy in Scripture.
That's right. All of the memos contain Bible passages to emphasize the policy. So, for instance, part of the policy is that if a child comes to an elder claiming that someone in the congregation had abused them, if that child doesn't have another witness, then the elders won't investigate it. And that comes from Deuteronomy, where it says something to the effect of, let no single man rise up against another man at the mouth of two or three witnesses, the matter should stand good. So the idea is, if there aren't two witnesses to an act of child abuse, they don't deal with it.
So Trey Bundy, let's flash forward a little bit to a specific case that's at the heart of your piece. Who is Candace Conti?
Candace Conti is a woman who grew up in the Jehovah's Witness organization in Fremont, California. In the early 90s, she was attending the congregation there with a man named Jonathan Kendrick, who was also a witness. She claims that Jonathan, for about 2 years when she was 9 or 10 years old, was abusing her. They would go out together preaching door-to-door Bible literature, and he would use those opportunities to take her to his house and sexually abuse her. So she didn't say anything about it for years to anybody. But one day in 2009, she found Kendrick on a sex offender website and realized that he had gone on after her to molest another girl. So at that point, she went to her old congregation, talked to the elders. Because she didn't have a witness to the abuse, they wouldn't investigate it any further. And she decided to sue the Watchtower.
All right, let's hear from Candace Conti in her own words.
I wasn't going to take the back seat. I wanted to go full steam ahead and expose them for what they really were and the policies and the procedures for what they really were.
After Kendrick had sexually abused Candace Conti, he moved to a town called Oakley, about 60 miles north. When he moved there, the elders at his old congregation had sent a letter to the elders in Oakley to introduce him. And in that letter, they essentially said that he was good with kids, that he was a fine brother, and then they mentioned nothing about child abuse at all. Kendrick ended up marrying a woman in Oakley and went on to molest her granddaughter.
A new report on a culture of concealment and denial of sexual abuse within the Jehovah's Witnesses. Trey Bundy, reporter for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We turn now to Ukraine, where at midnight on Sunday, a ceasefire between Russian-backed separatists and the Ukrainian army took effect. Already, that very fragile deal has been broken. According to the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, more than 100 cases of artillery fire between the two sides have been reported since early Sunday in the contested area of Debaltseve. Andrew Kramer, reporter for our partner, The New York Times, joins me now from the supply route on the road to Debaltseve. Welcome, Andrew.
Hello. Thank you for having me on.
Andrew, you are outside on a road that is disputed and that the Ukrainian army is trying to use as a supply route.
That's right. The Ukrainian military claims that this road is open, but in fact, it is mostly closed, and nobody has made it out since Thursday, with the exception of a few stragglers and soldiers who are seeking medical care and have managed to either walk across the fields or dash out in a dangerous attempt to escape. About 8,000 soldiers are said to be trapped inside. Now, just today, Life News, a news agency with close connections to the Russian security services, released a video showing their reporter on this road walking amid destroyed tanks and dead Ukrainian soldiers. seeming to provide proof that the separatists do, in fact, control a portion of this road. This would be a military defeat and a major setback for Ukraine if it is left in this situation. It's not contested, or they're not able to walk this back through negotiations.
Andrew Kramer, what is the state of the ceasefire at this very moment? We understand some shells continued flying right after midnight and the agreement, but that they were isolated. What's the state of the ceasefire now?
The ceasefire is being violated on multiple occasions on this small part of the front. Out here on this road, it's a snowy day. It's very hard to see farther than a few hundred meters, but we can hear from time to time the hollow booms of artillery. Elsewhere in Ukraine, there have been few reported violations. Just today, there was a report of 5 Ukrainian soldiers killed outside of the city of Mariupol and a hospital damaged in the town of Shastya to the east of where I am. Overall, the violence has diminished considerably since Saturday when the ceasefire took effect.
And before we let you go, Andrew Kramer, how desperate are Ukrainian soldiers or Ukrainian people for American weapons? To hear it on our side in Washington, they're absolutely desperate for U.S. anti-tank artillery that they can use in the fight. Is that the case there?
Well, Ukrainian soldiers are certainly desperate to have better weaponry. Ukraine is losing this war. The most that can be said at this point is they're not giving up without a fight. That said, I would not say unequivocally the Ukrainian people are asking for American weapons. This would inevitably lead to an escalation, perhaps a wider war, and opinions would be divided on that.
Andrew Kramer from our partner, The New York Times, on the road to Debaltseve. Andrew, thank you.
Thank you for having me on.
It's been a busy few days for German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Negotiations for the now broken ceasefire in Ukraine late last week took her to Minsk and London and Washington and a handful of other stops. And today, she continues deliberations over the Greek bailout at the European Council summit in Brussels. Jan van Aken is a member of the German parliament and of Germany's left-wing party, and he says even momentary peace in Ukraine is something to celebrate.
Actually, nobody expected it to hold even for a minute, so it was a very positive surprise over the weekend that at least something happened there for a while. So that gives us some hope. So, and you really have to say this is, to some extent, really the success of Angela Merkel. Without her, I'm sure there wouldn't have been any kind of ceasefire and no hope at all right now.
It seems, taking a step back, that Angela Merkel's vision for a united Europe is really what's at stake here.
Yeah, and I'm not sure whether this is her vision. I think if we look at the Greek question and what happened in the last 3 years with the European and Euro crisis, I think Angela Merkel was more of a problem than of a solution. And when you now listen to Southern Europeans, be it in Greece, be it in Spain, be it in Italy, there's such an anger and sometimes even such an hatred towards Germany that it's really, I think, from my point of view, that's really endangering the basic idea of the European Union, that the people of Europe grow together. Right now, it's more divided than ever.
Now, what's at stake when it comes to Greece, essentially, is whether or not Greece is going to stick to tough austerity measures that were negotiated in the last bailout. Chancellor Merkel says they have to stick to it. That has led to a lot of the repercussions that you're talking about. Isn't she just reflecting what the polls in Germany, what most Germans, her constituents, say they want, which is for Greece to stick to austerity?
Exactly. I mean, she's very populistic in this way. She's just trying to impose the harsh German reforms we had here in the past 10 years to impose it on all of Europe. And she's saying not a single dime for any Southern European country if they are not cutting on wages, if they are not, you know, laying off public employees and so on and so forth. We see now, 3 years later, that it really is a big problem in these countries. The economy is getting worse and worse and not better. I mean, this is what every economist can tell you. So there's a big debate. And I think even in France and the French government, they are looking to lift some of these very harsh austerity measures. And Angela Merkel and the conservative government here in Germany is pretty much alone in Europe, but they have the economic power, and I'm afraid they were really trying to continue with this wrong policy.
We're going to be talking a little bit later in the show about the concept of appeasement and accusations of appeasement in Europe and sort of what they mean culturally and politically when they're thrown. And Jan van Aken, you know, a lot of American observers are accusing Angela Merkel
of just that when it comes to Vladimir Putin. She's not getting tough. She's appeasing Vladimir Putin. Give us the German perspective, not only on what she's doing in negotiating with Putin in eastern Ukraine, but also that term, what it means to Germans versus what it means to the rest of the world.
It's interesting. I think there's really two very different German views on it. And even within Angela Merkel's party, I think there's one half of her party and of her government who really wants to take a much harsher stand against Vladimir Putin, very much on the US line. And the other half says, we will never, ever have peace in Europe against Russia. There will only be peace in Europe with Russia. So we really have to readjust our Russian policy that really went totally wrong over the past 25 years. So there is a lot of talk, even in conservative areas, that we really have to shift our policy. And it's not even appeasement. It's really getting to a cooperative agreement with Putin in the long term.
Jan van Aken, member of the German parliament and Germany's left-wing party, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
You know, there's a strange comparison getting made with increasing frequency, it seems. Here's one example that gets kind of close to it. Take a listen to what Senator John McCain said to me a little more than a year ago when I asked him about a certain handshake of geopolitical proportions on the sidelines of Nelson Mandela's funeral.
Senator, what do you make of the handshake between the president and Raul Castro in South Africa today?
Gives Raul some propaganda to continue to prop up his dictatorial, brutal regime. That's all.
Should he not have done it?
Of course not. Why should you shake hands with somebody who's keeping Americans in prison? I mean, why, what's the point? Neville Chamberlain shook hands with Hitler.
Now, it's becoming increasingly common in American political culture to compare your enemies to Hitler. And how did Hitler succeed? Through appeasement from the Allies. And Senator McCain has been playing the appeasement card more recently over the debate over whether to send arms to Ukraine. He said, history shows us that dictators will always take more if you let them, a direct reference to Neville Chamberlain and Adolf Hitler in Europe. And he's far from alone. Donald Tusk, a former prime minister of Poland and current president of the European Council last month, implied in a tweet that Chancellor Angela Merkel was guilty of appeasement. And how about this from the old chess grandmaster turned anti-Putin advocate, Garry Kasparov? He said, my problem is today you have so many politicians lining up to become a new Chamberlain. Where are the Churchills? He asks. So with this most fragile ceasefire in place, how helpful are historical comparisons when it comes to the Ukraine crisis? When is this soundbite diplomacy more than just an easy dig? Well, Kenneth Davis is with us. He's author and creator of the Don't Know Much About series, and his upcoming book, The Hidden History of America at War, is coming out in May, and he joins me now. Kenneth, hello.
Always a great pleasure to be with you.
And it's always great to have you. Now, the backstory is a little bit easy to understand. Appeasement. Neville Chamberlain, Prime Minister of Great Britain in 1938 in Europe. What happened between him and Hitler that we're all referring to today as the big don't do?
Well, this is, of course, right after Hitler had gone into Austria in what was called the Anschluss, the takeover of Austria. Hitler was threatening to invade Czechoslovakia, what was then called Czechoslovakia, and parts of Poland as well. This is all the aftermath of the First World War, the war to end all wars, when parts of Germany had been taken away and the maps of Europe were redrawn. Hitler thought that this was all an affront to German history, tradition, and was clearly making a very large effort to retake some of those territories, German-speaking territories. Chamberlain meets Hitler in Munich, September 1938. They shake hands. They make a deal. He thinks that he has won the peace, partly a peace that he thought would be time for him to rearm Great Britain. You mentioned Churchill in your intro there, and it's always wise to quote Churchill in a moment like this. He said after this, of course, England has been offered a choice between war and shame. She has chosen shame and will get war. And of course, that was correct. So do we draw direct parallels between Chamberlain and Chancellor Merkel and Hitler and Putin? That's where we're on much shakier ground.
Right, because the historical antecedents are there of a leader taking some land, saying, we just want this. In Hitler's case, German-speaking ethnic Germans. In Putin's case, there were Russian-speaking Ukrainians in Crimea and in eastern Ukraine. Some of the similarities were too much to swallow for many on the West there. But there's the broader question that people say is proven by the example, that if a dictator or a foreign leader that we don't agree with asks for one thing, you never negotiate. And that's a tougher question.
That is a tougher question, because that would mean diplomacy can never work and that there's nothing that's subject to compromise, and we always have to go right to the sabers. Saber rattling is, you know, sometimes a good and necessary thing. It's when we draw the wrong lessons of history that we get into danger. You know, we always talk about not learning the history lessons at all. Sometimes it's even worse to learn the wrong lessons. We Americans in particular have a very Americanized view of what happened in 1938 and what happened in European history. People in Germany and certainly in Russia and certainly in England and France, for that matter, all of Europe has a very, very different view of what happened then. The loss of tens and tens of millions of lives in two wars spread between 1914 and 1945. And that's the historical context that we Americans sometimes don't bring to this, that the devastation that Europe suffered in these two world wars.
Right. And it's that context we want to emphasize. None of this discussion is about an argument for going easy on Putin necessarily. But you mentioned the irony of this argument taking place in Germany itself now. We just had a discussion of calls within Germany saying that Angela Merkel, the chancellor, is appeasing Putin, the German leader. There's a huge irony there that these accusations are coming from within Germany itself.
Oh, absolutely. The idea that Germany is acting the part of the appeaser in this case, and that's coming from within Germany, is a rich historical irony. And when we can sit on the sidelines and consider that, that's one thing. I suppose the real historical analogy, if we want to get into comparisons, is, you know, what do we think Putin's aims, designs are, as opposed to what Hitler's stated and clear aims and desires were. They were. I think that's one point of difference that we have to be very careful about. And look, we've seen how wars, once they get started, they're hard to stop. And and that's one of the real lessons of history. Most wars, I think, you can look back and say it was, was this a just or an unjust war? Was this a necessary or an avoidable war? And certainly 1914, there were all the reasons in the world not to have it go ahead, but it did, at tremendous cost in lives. And the after effect of that, of course, led to another world war.
And we have lots of, also in the modern day, lots of mental shortcuts that get made. The Obamacare computer meltdown was Obama's Katrina, or Charlie Hebdo is France's 9/11, things like that.
Any of those quick comparisons is what it is, a quick comparison that needs a little bit more thought.
That's Kenneth Davis. He's author and creator of the Don't Know Much About series and the upcoming book, The Hidden History of America at War, coming out in May. You can check out more at don'tknowmuch.com. That's all one word. Kenneth, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
And be sure to join us tomorrow. We're talking with CIA whistleblower John Kiriakou. Kiriakou was imprisoned for leaking classified information to reporters, making him the first CIA officer to be imprisoned for leaks or for any kind of wrongdoing at all, in connection with the CIA's torture policies. He says those decisions are reverberating in today's images.
Our torture program has resulted in an ease of recruitment for groups like ISIS or like Al-Qaeda. When they see videos from Guantanamo or they hear about torture programs, it makes it easier for them to market themselves in poor villages around the Middle East and recruit new young men to fight for them. That's the real problem.
That's tomorrow on the show. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, and this is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.